Have you watched Severance?
Oh my God, that was the next one I was gonna say. I actually think that Severance is doing something very new and interesting as well.
Forgotten Corner podcast would not exist without our listeners. If you enjoy the work we are doing on this show and would like to support further, please consider a donation through our Patreon account. patreon.com/forgottencornerpod or visit our website forgottencornerpod.com. Welcome back to the Forgotten Corner podcast. We acknowledge that the Forgotten Corner occupies unceded Indigenous land. We acknowledge that the Blackfoot Confederacy never surrendered its land in the signing of Treaty 7, but agreed to share it. The Forgotten Corner sits on Treaty 7 and Treaty 4 territory, traditional lands of the Siksika, Kainai, Piikani, Stony Nakoda and Tsuut'ina, as well as the Cree, Sioux, and the Soto bands of the Ojibwa peoples. We also honor and acknowledge that we are on the Métis Nation within Region 3. The Forgotten Corner is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, and it's a very Harbinger Media Network episode today. So if you'd like to check out other progressive podcasts from across the country, click the link we provide in our show notes. And specifically today, we'll probably be providing the link to a very specific podcast that you'll hear about today when we get going. My name is Scott Schmidt. I am the co-host here alongside my co-host Jeremy Appel from Edmonton, Alberta.
Well, I'm not from Edmonton.
Jesus Christ. Does anybody know? Okay. Do you want a Wikipedia bio or like he's in Edmonton? Is that better?
Yes. Well, yeah. On stolen land in Edmonton, as you know.
Soon to be published author Jeremy Appel.
Yeah. Eventually to be published author is how I'd like to put it.
A little bit pissed off that I haven't been asked to edit any chapters, but whatever.
Oh, don't worry. I will.
Can better be.
Don't worry. I got you. I got you, Scott.
Roberta told me she was editing a chapter, and I was just like, let's see how this works. Like, goddamn bullshit. Anyway, other than like being swamped with a first draft that's due in like 7 weeks, how are things up there?
They're good. You know, we've got sheriffs coming to town.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, they're gonna crack some homeless people's skulls. It's really fucking bleak.
Good. Yeah, it's about time we cleaned up the disorder, as they say. Yeah.
Fuck. It's like Danielle Smith is like Judge Dredd.
That's her big thing, right? Let's increase the presence and reach of the police, because as we all know, nothing prevents crime like a cop.
Like a good libertarian, right?
That's right.
We need to strengthen the arm of the state. Only when it comes to the police. When it comes to education, we need like an app to connect people to like teachers.
Yeah, we just need one sheriff for every like derelict. They can just kind of be side by side and walk around and everything will be fine. There's no problem. It's just people that are too lazy to I don't know. What's the narrative? These just a bunch of lowlifes, I guess. It's not capitalism.
Yeah, well, it's just that crime's out of control and there's no cause to it. It's just chaos and you know, we need
our economic system is fine.
We need John Wayne to come to town and you know, tame the frontier is the sort of image I think that's being conjured.
It's pretty fucking awful, and Medicine Hat's like trying to act like we have issues downtown, and being all like, we're gonna watch, see how it unfolds in Edmonton and Calgary, but you know. Like, not saying, like, hey, we're interested, but kind of saying we're interested. And the good news is we did a poll, very unscientific poll, of course, but whether people wanted to see sheriffs downtown, and no one won the vote. So I guess that's good.
Well, when I was there, they had, like, a downtown patrol unit that like still walk still do downtown.
So there yeah still do there was three constables, three officers. I'm not sure if what their rankings were, but there's now one retired and one, I don't know, switched divisions or moved away or something like that, and they haven't had anyone. So there's one person on this downtown patrol. We just had a story about all because of the sheriff's thing. We just broke this all down this week, so it's kind of fresh in my mind. But anyway,
yeah, I actually read it yesterday. I was like, "What's the Medicine Hat News up to?"
not a lot.
Well, I guess what's going on in the city I called home for a few years. But
yeah, I don't want to like make any like accusations, but murder is pretty much stopped after you left. So.
Whatever happened with that Robert Huffman guy? Isn't he like...
He's appealing his sentence and conviction at the moment.
Yeah, I thought I read that.
Or one of the other... I can't remember. Can you appeal both at the same time? I don't think it matters, but he's not going to win. He's...
Yeah. That is a crazy murder, listener. I would suggest you look
yeah,
that
yeah,
up.
Yeah, look that up. In fact, our custodian, it was her brother, unfortunately, that was the random victim in this message sending murder in an extortion case. Fucked up. Anyway, let's get on with the show because our guest has been so patient sitting here listening to us, and we both know that that can't be that fun. So yeah, I'm gonna sit back and let you introduce her and then we'll get going.
All right. Our guest today is a professor of the humanities at York University. She's also the co-host of a little podcast called Replay on the Harbinger Media Network, which she co-hosts with Desmond Cole. Before that, she was a professor at the University of Alberta in the city she was raised in. Welcome to the show, Shama Rangwala.
Thanks for that introduction. I'm going to fact check it a little bit. So I wasn't a professor at U of A. I did my PhD there, so I taught there for a long time. But yeah, I am a professor, assistant professor at York. So the city I was raised in is also something maybe we can talk about. But I think that I can say more than you that I'm quote unquote from Edmonton with all the conditions attached to that. But I'm in Toronto, so isn't that where you're from? So we kind of...
Yeah, we did. We swapped cities.
Yeah, we swapped, but you're going to move here.
I bet if I would have said she's coming to us from Toronto, she wouldn't have gone into a whole like argument of the semantics of the whole thing. But hey, whatever, right?
Well, I'm definitely not from Toronto because I just moved here right before our fall term started. So I feel very new to this city, but I do really like being here. I mean, I'm going to, you know, if all goes well, I'll be here till, you know, I retire or the race water wars like flush us out of the urban center. I don't know.
So quick message to our patrons. If I'd like to hear from you, would you like to hear us go back to the whole, you know, we write an intro before we start and then we read it to the guest before we record. And then they tell us if we're wrong about anything. And then by the time we record, we present something professional and proper. Or would you like to hear us continue to do it like this, where we wing it off the top of our heads, get 50 to 60% of it wrong and throw a bunch of and ahs in there? You tell us, because we'll if you let the authenticity of what we just did, we'll keep doing it. Laziness is our thing.
Embrace chaos.
That's right. Okay, so it is the Forgotten Corner. Everyone that listens to this show knows that this is sort of life story time. This is when we kind of get into who you are, where you're from, and apparently we're going to make some argument that it could be Edmonton along the way here. So if you kind of want to start with sort of you're a little bit about your background, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I was born in Edmonton, which is why I think I can say that my life originated there. lived there until I was 12, and then my family went to Saudi Arabia to the Aramco camp in Dahran. So it's like full of Californians and Texans. My dad was working for Aramco. So I lived there for a couple of years, which was kind of interesting. It was very insulated from this, from like what we would call like real Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Because it was all Americans there. A few Canadians, you know, we were Canadian. But yeah, it was a very interesting place. And this would have been like in the late 90s. To the kind of early 2000s ish, except I like they were there for that long, but I left to go to boarding school in Western Massachusetts, Deerfield Academy, for those who know New England boarding schools. And my politics are kind of against the existence of such an institution, but I benefited from it so much. And like when you're 14 and somebody's like, do you want to go to like one of the best schools in the world? And it's in like beautiful rural Massachusetts. And so of course I was like very excited to go and made some friends who I'm still friends with today there. Cause you live at school. So like your friends become your family. But yeah, of course it should not exist, but you know, there's like a tension within me of like the good experience that I had there, or, you know, high school is sure. hard for all kinds of reasons, but I think that like I probably wouldn't be, you know, where I am today without having those kinds of experiences and like learning and reading and thinking about ideas and stuff in that kind of environment. So yeah, then after that, I went to England for a year and did this like, you know, Canadians would know about this maybe because Queen's University owns this castle in East Sussex. So I did this castle program. And then I lived in Montreal after that and did my undergrad and master's at McGill. Back to Edmonton, right? So I never thought that I would go back to Edmonton. But at the time when I was applying for PhD programs, it really was one of the best in Canada for the kinds of things that I wanted to do. Also like really good oil time for the economy. It would have been 2010. So like they offered me a ton of funding and I was like, okay, you know what, back to Alberta. And yeah, so I was at UVA for a long time. And then I got this job at York. And so I did it online a bit during the pandemic, but just moved to Toronto before fall term. So that's like the kind of geographical biography.
Right.
I guess I lived in Japan for a year when I was like 6 and 7.
So I want to back you up to when you first went to Saudi Arabia. One, because it's intriguing me on the time frame. And I want to be one of those, hey, do you know Doug from Toledo guys? But my a really good friend of mine, Chris Roberts, he did kind of that same thing. His dad was a oil and gas engineer, I think, and they ended up in Saudi Arabia when he was young, and it would have been around the same time frame that they would have been there, that you were there. And I'm sure that that doesn't, but I mean, there weren't very many Canadians when he was there, so he obviously but anyway, he ended up coming back and going to a boarding school. And I just kind of, as I'm hearing you tell it, I'm like, it's very similar story to what I heard. So when you, I like to rack his brain a little bit about his time over there. I mean, you spent your first 12 years in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and then your Saudi Arabia. Can you just talk about sort of what that was like as a child to do? What were some of the culture shocks you kind of endured? Yeah. And also kind of what it was like to be female in Saudi Arabia when you were a kid?
Yeah. So I hated it. Really, like I think that I know that I benefited from that experience in so many ways, and certainly like growing up with like you know comfortable money around me, like because of that, like that is like a huge obviously a huge benefit. But I went when I was 12, so everybody like in my middle school kind of grew up together in this like really insular place. So I did make friends, but I really felt like an outsider because I hadn't spent my childhood there. So it was like alienating in lots of different ways. You know, there, I think that I haven't been back in so long, so I know that it's not the same, but where we lived, it was next to this town, like an actual or a city, Khobar, which was really used to foreigners. So like people weren't veiling very much, especially like if you weren't Saudi, like if you weren't subject to like the laws of this. You are subject to the laws of the states, but you have like a different kind of relationship to it when you are not a citizen. So we didn't like cover our hair or our faces like when we went out, but it was actually easier to wear an abaya, which is like the long black robe that you zip up, because you don't want people like staring at you. So it just like makes it easier to move through spaces and stuff, right? So like women couldn't drive then. So I learned how to drive in Saudi Arabia, actually, in the American camp, because, you know, I was like a teenager coming back from boarding school. So I don't know if I like the name Chris Roberts is like kind of a generic.
It's so generic.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, who knows? Like, there's probably several different places around Saudi Arabia that have camps full of.
There are, but Dahran is the biggest one. So, there's smaller ones. Like, there's three other Aramco camps in the Eastern Province, but like mostly like people would live in Dahran or like around it. There's like the U.S. consulate and stuff too. So, I mean, I would say like, you know, I teach this article a lot by Laila Abu-Lugod called Do Muslim Women Really Need Saving, which is about the politics of veiling. And I think that there's like a discourse in the West of like, you know, Spivak, Gayatri Spivak calls it like saving brown women from brown men, and like this kind of Orientalist look on like, oh, look at how they treat their women, et cetera, et cetera. At the same, like, so I'm very like critical of like framing of like, oh, it's like, you know, how could you like be a woman in Saudi Arabia or this or that, right? I mean, I was a adolescent to teenager, but at the same time, like, I will say that it was quite like a shock for me to see people like fully veiled. It's a different way to like experience social space. It was hard for me to live there. In the camp, it was, you know, it was like a little Californian town. Like, you know, it was there weren't like a lot of restrictions around that. Like, women could, like, I learned how to drive there. And they tried to make it comfortable. So there's like a golf course, but instead of grass, it was like packed sand. So it's like hard turf, so not like a sand trap, but it was sand. And they had like beaches where, you know, you couldn't wear a bikini, but you could wear like a one piece, pools, tennis courts. There was a movie theater in the camp. So now I think there are movie theaters kind of all over Saudi Arabia, or at least like in the urban centers, but that was not the case then. So, you know, we could see movies, but they would be like 6 months late. And there was like, we would have satellite dishes. So we would get TV from Asia. So I would watch like Channel V, like If You Know, You Know. There's like Much Music, or sorry, MTV Asia, and not Much Music, that's Canada, but MTV Asia and Channel V. So it was like I'm glad that I had that experience, because I think it really like opened me up to like the ways that different people, we also got to travel a lot.
Well, that was sort of my next question, was kind of like, how much did that period shape who you are and what you sort of were interested in studying? Because you did women and gender studies and humanities now. I mean, these are all things that probably would have been open, your eyes would have opened more to it outside of, you know, Edmonton, Alberta, where things at that time probably seemed pretty hunky-dory.
So I've never done women's and gender studies. Oh. I was there for a year teaching in that department, but like none of my degrees are like, it's not like a area.
But you did teach in women and gender studies.
Yeah, I did for a year. So, no, like I can talk about the genealogy of my work. I would say that it does not come from living in Saudi, but at Deerfield. So at Deerfield, I was playing piano a lot and singing. Like, I was really, really involved in the music program. So I was, you know, playing piano for like few hours a day sometimes, like really studying like as seriously as you would if you're not gonna become a concert pianist. And so, you know, I was doing that, and I was really interested in art history, and I took this class my junior year called American Spaces that was an American literature course, but every other week we would have one lecture on art history. So I was always trying to think about the literature that we were reading in relation to other aesthetic movements of that time. So like really thinking across forms. So that was my junior year of high school. And really like that, the area that I was most interested in was modernism. So that's sort of what I started doing. I started my undergrad in political science, and that was maybe influenced by living in Saudi. And then I hated it because it was so like conservative and orientalist. And of course, this is the early 2000s. So a lot of those departments were just kind of the purpose of them was to provide the intellectual or scholarly buttressing for war. So, I was like, OK, I'm not going to do this. And at McGill, they had cultural studies. And so my undergrad degree is in cultural studies, but I did a lot of modernism. The political science stuff was definitely, I think, influenced by living in Saudi and really like trying to understand global politics, like loosely defined. But then I hated it, and which makes sense considering that the time in cultural studies was like much more interesting to me. And so like my PhD research was in canonical literature of the modernist period and their film adaptations. So, really like thinking across forms. So that's something that I'm teaching a course right now at York, like a seminar called Modernism Across the Arts. So yeah, like I think that came from Deerfield, but I'm still, I'm very interested in politics. Saying y'all know, like I do some like media stuff, like talking about politics. Right. So yeah.
I took a great course when I was at York. That's actually where I did my undergrad with, Balfour, I think his last name was, professor. That was just focusing on adaptations from like literature to film. So we watched like and read The Wizard of Oz and The Shining and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and a bunch of other books and movies. It was a great class.
Yeah, so I think that's probably, I haven't met a lot of people yet because not just because I got here, but there's still this pandemic. And so I think otherwise we would be having lots of parties and stuff for like new faculty to meet people. But it's been more like one-on-one stuff that I've been meeting people and just like in my immediate like department area. But yeah, that sounds great. I mean, yeah, I think that there's a lot in adaptation studies that's a bit like books do this and movies do this, but what I'm interested in is kind of historicizing both like the source text and the adaptation to think about how these like systems of racial capitalism have adapted. So when I look at the early 20th century to the 21st century, like there are different kinds of things happening, like there are different material conditions that are and different kinds of like cultures like emerging out of those, right? But what does it mean to like try to retell this story, and also like with a change in medium too? So those are some of the kind of research questions of my PhD.
Ian Balfour is his name.
Yeah, so I've heard, I know who that is. I just like haven't met him yet.
Yeah, he was awesome. Yeah, and I guess like this sort of connection between like popular culture and racial capitalism, and sort of how the latter is perpetuated in the former. I mean, that's sort of a consistent thread throughout your work. I mean, your podcast Replay with Desmond is essentially doing that, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess what is it about that connection between racial capitalism and popular culture that like really like stood out to you and made you be like, this is what I want my life's work to be, or at least part of my life's work to be?
Yeah. So I can trace a genealogy to this as well. So in undergrad, when I switched from political science, which was a lot of like, why should we intervene in other countries, to cultural studies, where it was like, why do we think the things that we do? And like, why do we like the things that we do? Or like, what is the relationship between? So one of the, you know, central questions of cultural studies is, you know, why do certain kinds of culture emerge at certain particular historical moments? So I would say, like, I read Frederick Jameson's The Political Unconscious, I think, in my senior year of undergrad. And I like was like mind blown. So this is a book. It's one of the most like famous books of literary theory, and of Marxist literary theory. And his claim is that narrative is a socially symbolic act. All narrative is a socially symbolic act, and that it provides imaginary resolutions to real social contradictions. So whatever like real social contradictions are happening in this historical moment, it will kind of narrativize some kind of imaginary resolution to that. So we can like interpret social contradictions really, really broadly. And yeah, so like some of the example, I think the first example, this is one I use in my class, but the first example, the way it was taught to me was to think about how with Star Wars, you know, the first Star Wars trilogy, you have the Empire being like vaguely foreign and having like British accents sometimes, or Darth Vader doesn't even look human, right? And they have this like weapon of mass destruction. And the rebels who are fighting against the Empire are like, you know, 1920 screwball comedy heroine and Princess Leia. You have the like cowboy who like reluctantly becomes a hero in Han Solo, and you're like all American farm boy in Luke Skywalker. And so the claim of like this kind of a reading would not be George Lucas wanted to like justify the Vietnam War. It would be, what does it mean for a culture that is like feeling kind of maybe some kind of way about like bombing villages and like, you know, using weapons of mass destruction of like the chemical warfare on like people who, you know, are do not have the same kind of force, right? Back to them, right? What does it mean to, for how would a culture try to find some kind of imaginary resolution to this idea of being like, we're the most freest people in the world. We're the ones who want to like bring democracy and like blah, 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 right? And so it's not like about intentionality, but it's about what are the things happening in that historical moment that have, you know, that lead to like some, you know, just like this, you know, space opera, right? So, you know, you can see like lots of ways that this plays out. I think like Marvel movies are also doing a lot of this, this work, right now. So yeah, I was just like really mind blown, by thinking about history and culture in this way. And it's still the way that I think about history and culture, that they're like material conditions, and culture kind of emerges from those. So this is like very classic, like Marxist, like base superstructure. But of course, there's complications and other people to read. Like I have, there's lots of things to say after that. But for these purposes, like that was when I was first starting to think about it. So yeah, when we look at, like I teach like Lemonade in my first, actually in a couple of my classes, so Beyonce, so like what does it mean to have like a text that is so so like beautiful and like traces such a like genealogy and like cinema history to like Daughters of the Dust, that's so you know, personal but also universalizing the personal experience, that is so attuned to the experiences of like Black women, specifically Southern Black women, and also, you know, ends with like Best Revenge Is Your Paper, that is like such a like wholesale embrace of individual success within capitalism. You know, these are like the things that I talk about in my class and like ask students to think about. So yeah, and like with the podcast with Desmond, we just like watch a lot of stuff together and like talk about pop culture. So we're like, why don't we just record it when we feel like, you know, we have something good going. So yeah, it's been really fun. We have lots of ideas for new episodes. It's been like a really busy.
Is it harder to enjoy film and art now because like do you feel like you're watching with like a more scrutiny or like a bit more of a focused lens when you're watching and heart, you know?
I would ask like what enjoyment means.
So you enjoy what you're doing with them is what you're saying.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. Do I watch like trash? For sure. I watch a lot of trash. Do I like a lot of things that have really like shitty reactionary politics? Yeah. Like I've played through Witcher 3 twice. Like, you know?
Right.
So like I feel like it's pleasurable for me to think about why a text is doing the things that it's doing. So that is enjoyable to me. So yeah.
Yeah. You're also a big gamer. How do you like, do you see gaming as sort of like an escape from all this, like, you know, big, like, intellectual ideas that you're normally doing with? Because it sounds like it's part and parcel.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all, because I'm actually currently just thinking about form and subjectivity in, like, video games and novels. So, no, it's just another cultural form, right? So, I can't turn off my brain when I listen to, like, a symphony or play a video game, but keep it on when I'm like reading a novel. Like that's like just not how that works, you know? So my brain's like always on, but like sometimes it's mediated through like, I don't know, a glass or two of wine or something, but it's always good. But again, it's because I find it pleasurable to think about mediation in this way, right? Culture as a form of mediation. So yeah, am I a big gamer? I am a new gamer. I am still calling myself a new gamer, but it's because I never played video games until the start of the pandemic when everybody was playing Animal Crossing and there was nary a Switch to be purchased. Like I was looking on all the websites and then one of my students was like, I can get you one for $500 on Kijiji and deliver it. And I was like, fuck yeah. So like he came and just like left it outside because it was the deep pandemic, just like left it outside my door and like left. And then I was like, oh my God. So Animal Crossing was my gateway. Then I played Breath of the Wild or Skyrim. So, you know, then Witcher. And then a year ago, I got a PlayStation 5. So then I was like, okay, like now it's, you know, all of the big games. So like Horizon Zero Dawn and Forbidden West is something that I really love and will probably be writing something about. Because it's like really interesting kind of representation of history and like dialectics. And
have you played The Last of Us since that's all anyone's talking about? Okay, right,
I'm in the middle of Last of Us 2 right now.
Okay.
Because I played Last of Us 1, like it's really quick, like it's a really short game. So I played that like a couple of weeks. I don't know what time it is, but in any case, as soon as I finished that, I played the like prequel DLC. And then I I'm like halfway through Last of Us 2.
Well, that's the second season of the show, apparently, is the one you're in right now will be season 2 of the show.
Yeah, it's giving me like really fucked up dreams. And, I don't know. There's a lot to say about it, right? So I will say that, like, I haven't been looking at a lot of, like, game studies scholarship. And I hate to do this where I'm like, oh, like, it's mostly bad. I think a lot of adaptation studies stuff is mostly, like, not that interesting. But with the game studies, I haven't gotten – this is, like, no insult to people who do game studies. It's just been, like, in my kind of superficial, just kind of, like, browsing the, like, virtual shelves of, like, game studies. Maybe they're not like interested in some of the same questions I am. It seems like a lot of digital humanities stuff. So I haven't gotten really into game studies, but like, I'm going to write something on Horizon, but I'm using my same like kind of Marxist cultural studies perspective, probably, you know, for that. So yeah, I'm in the middle of Last of Us. It's really good. It's anti-Black. The first one, I kind of don't want to give spoilers for it, but I can say like if you are representing like people who are fleeing something and they're Black, like maybe don't have them like kill themselves for the futurity of the white characters. Right. It's like a problem in like a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff. I've written an article on The Handmaid's Tale as like deeply anti-black. That's in Public Books if anyone's interested. But yeah, so it's like something that happens. So that's like my only like real problem with it. Otherwise, like I think it's really good.
So like there's all this, and I'm not, believe me, I am not, I like watch films and that's, you know, I don't do a lot of analyzing of them and whatnot, but a lot of people have sort of the narrative of like Hollywood is like woke culture and everything is just about like, and it sounds a lot like you kind of challenge that in a sense that like a lot of the movies that people might, or a lot of movies or films or games that people might interpret as being like a liberal message or some sort of, are actually not, and are actually maybe towing the line a bit. Is, am I close?
Yeah. So liberalism is the status quo. So yeah, I mean, I'm not a liberal, like, Let's make one thing clear. But yeah, so like what's happening in pop culture right now is I think that it's like deeply invested in representational politics, where it is all of the same shit, like of like patriarchy and capitalism, but they'll like put some melanin in it and say like, look, isn't, or they'll have like a queer couple who's like the form of that couple. And it's like kind of social being is like extremely conventional and status quo. It's like something like Modern Family, that sitcom where like they're so deeply normative. They're saying that you can be anybody as long as you inhabit
this. As long as you're kind of like this. Yeah.
Yeah. You inhabit this form of normativity. So you have a lot of, you know, these like reboots and things like that, right? That they're like, oh, let's put some melanin in there, or let's like make a Ghostbusters with women or whatever. But you know, when people use the word woke like that, it's all, it's like anti-black. But it's, you know, they're saying that like they've lost something. They've lost the kind of like cishet, like white patriarchal culture that of yore or whatever, right? But you know, it's not that these liberal pop culture texts are not doing anything like for the actual like liberation of people, like, right, at all. Like, in fact, what they're doing is strengthening, you know, structures of hegemony, like domination with consent, right? They're strengthening that by saying that, look at how inclusive we are, right? But it's inclusive within racial capital, like liberal racial capitalism, right? So yeah, I don't think that Hollywood is too quote unquote woke. I mean,
no, but that is a lot.
No,
of
I know that you were like, you saying know, the caricature, that's the caricature. But what is happening is, I think this is part of like what I think about with adaptation. There's different things going on. So like, I'm sort of working on something where I'm outlining different adaptive moves. So there's like the adaptive move of incorporation, where they'll see like, oh, there's like a threat to the system, right? So we'll incorporate that in. And my favorite example of this is Falcon and Winter Soldier coming after the 2020 you know, protests, after like the world saw the public murder and lynching of George Floyd.
Better,
you
know, make a black guy Captain America now.
Is, yeah, they made it. Yes, but the way that they did it, so what I'm saying with this adaptive move is, it's not just that they made a black Captain America, because that would not strengthen the status quo as much, right, as actually working through in very particular ways what was happening in 2020, right? So you have a black super soldier who says, the state tortured me. So that's an acknowledgement of like state violence against black people, right? Mm-hmm. You have that. You have Falcon and Winter Soldier getting stopped on the street by cops, and they're like, don't you know who he is? And they're acknowledging
that this police stuff target exists. Black people. Yep.
Like, they have to acknowledge all of that. They have to actually make it visible. It's not about disavowal. If it was about disavowal, they would just be like, Captain America's black now, like, deal with it, right? No. They were like, look at all of this stuff. And then the neutralization of that is, the museum scene at the end of Falcon and Winter Soldier where the Black Super Soldier gets an exhibit and he's happy about that. You know, a few episodes back, he's like, no Black man would ever want to be Captain America. And then they put him in a museum and he's like, okay, this is good now. And pretty so it's awesome, a very, very, it's like very particular kinds of moves of making something very visible and then neutralizing it.
So which kind, is a different of like, kind of like, in spite of this or that or the other thing, he still loves this. He loves what we do.
So it's narrativizing. It's narrativizing a way to acknowledge these like violences and to neutralize any kind of resistance against them. And so that is a really different kind of, so like they're like incorporating this critique into it and saying like, we're going to neutralize it through that incorporation. So I mean, it's like very insidious. They also have this, they're like flag smashers, like who are against, right, you know, the idea of the nation. Those are the villains, but they make them like conditionally sympathetic. They're like, we know why you would like to smash some flags.
Isn't that sort of like every villain in Marvel, especially? And I don't want to ruin Marvel universe for me because I actually do like it a lot. I mean, I was a comic book kid and I just grew up in the 80s and it is what it is. But like every villain is like, is he the good guy? Like, shouldn't he be the good guy? But at the same time, you're like, get him.
Because they'll do something that is beyond the pale, right? They will engage in some kind of violence, like Killmonger, like killing his girlfriend and choking that auntie in the garden, where they're like, his form of violence is just negation, whereas the hero's form of violence is like liberatory, right?
Right.
That like the whole movie of Black Panther is a kind of like neutralization of like a like Fanon, right? Like that's like the, there's other things happen. It's like nice to watch and like whatever. It's like pretty. And like, I think, you know, Chadwick Boseman is like wonderful, but like it is like has very like despicable politics. I'm not saying you can't like it.
No, I get it. I get it. It's absolutely, there are ways to extract entertainment out of something that you can at least see the problematic aspects of how movies are made or what seems to be the norm. And if you didn't, you probably couldn't participate in pop culture if you didn't, like, you know what I mean? Like, you have to be allowed to like be entertained.
I mean, so like back to like the Witcher example, like it's a kind of Hobbesian, like Eastern European fashy, like nightmare, but I love it. Like I've played through it twice. Like it's so funny about like gender too. Like it's, you know, but like, I just like make my Geralt, like he's so good. Like he helps everyone. Like he never like bargains for his pay. Like he just wants to help people.
So you get to be the sort of utopian person inside of these like dystopian things kind of thing.
I mean, maybe like that's one of the things that like RPGs maybe can afford us, because we are sort of role playing and we can build our characters the way that we want. I mean, I wonder about something like Breath of the Wild, because like, is there a kind of like denazification program or something? Because like, it does seem like the Bokoblins have some kind of culture, like they're dancing and they're singing and like they're telling stories around the campfire. And it's fine to kill them because Ganon resurrects them. But once you defeat Ganon, maybe like it's not fine to kill them now, right? Like that's like a real death. And so like, where is the denazification program of Hyrule? I don't know. May 2023, the next one's coming out. So we'll see.
Right.
Yeah, what are some of your other problematic faves?
Oh, my other problematic faves. Oh gosh, I'm just like looking at me. I mean, you know, I like a lot of like like music. I don't know. Like I can't talk about this, but like for a long time Kanye was like my favorite for like a really long time, and he's like hard to listen to now. Again, this is not like people shouldn't listen to him. I don't know. You know, there's like a different argument about giving somebody money, but that's probably my, like, it's, but I don't, he's not my fave anymore because I can't listen to him.
You know, I went through a month or two where I also, I couldn't listen to Kanye. Like it was just, and then I was going to the gym and I was like, you know what? I'm going to put on Graduation.
And, it's hard.
Oh my God.
It was so good. But and then I kind of got back on the like listening to Kanye a lot, but I still feel kind of gross about it.
No, it's bad. It's bad because it's also in the text itself, but we always kind of, I think, saw a wink in there and the wink has stopped. now, right? And so like he was saying all kinds of crazy shit before, but it felt like really thickly mediated, right? Like Monster, like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is one of my favorite albums of all time. I just haven't listened to it in a very long time and probably won't for I don't know. But you know, Monster, like everybody knows I'm a motherfucking monster. There's always that like wink or like runaway. It's like, no, you should run away from me because I'm like a fucking dick. Like there was that, but I feel like that's not happening anymore. But it's funny because in my dissertation, I have a chapter, this is out as an article. Well, part of it is out as an article in English Studies in Canada on The Great Gatsby and it's the adaptations of The Great Gatsby. So Nella Larsen's passing, and there are two adaptations. There's the Leonardo DiCaprio one, and there's the
Family Guy.
No, there's one called G. It's just called G. It's really bad, but it was doing particular work for me in the argument I was making. But the Baz Luhrmann Leo one has Jay-Z and Kanye on the soundtrack, and I have like I quote both of them in that chapter, and I contrast them with like a lot of Jay-Z lyrics that are about kind of infinite success within capitalism, and Kanye's like, even a Benz, you're still an N-word and a coupe, like the kind of understanding of the sort of ways that, well, as Stuart Hall would say, my favorite, he would say, like, race is the modality in which class is lived, right? And so, like, an attunement to that in that lyric, that, like, he's living this modality of class as like, a Black man, right? So I was so, like, in my thing that, like, was the end of my PhD, I was quite, like, complimentary to Kanye. So I guess that's an example of a problematic, like, former fave, maybe.
Well, I mean, Kanye was very socially conscious in, like, on his, like, first couple albums, right? And then it sort of became more, I think he looked inward more at his, like, personal demons. And, he's always been...
Wasn't it Pete Davidson that put on the hat, the MAGA hat that he had re-altered to say "Make Kanye 2006 again" or something like that?
I didn't see that, but
I was going to say there's a book from I think 2011 by Lauren Berlant that was really famous in like theory circles called "Cruel Optimism." So "Cruel Optimism" is like a structure where you are investing yourself in something that hinders your thriving. And I feel like Kanye was such a good rapper of cruel optimism. You know, all of the like vision of the good life. Does he have a song called The Good Life? Like
Good that, Life, that's like, yeah. Welcome
so,
to the good
like,
life.
Right, but like in Berlant's theory, like the good life is actually the trap. But I think that in Kanye's earlier work, like it was also a trap, right? In some ways, like in some of the songs, in some ways, right? So I don't know. Anyway, like, you know, Kanye, whatever, like people, like he's a rich asshole now. And it was probably there. It was probably there before. And it was in there. And the little winks, like we maybe overread the little winks that were like, I don't really mean what I say, perhaps.
Well, like, I remember when he came out with Black Skinhead, and,
thanks.
Yeah, great song, great album, but I was all, you know, it was on Yeezus, and Yeezus is full of those, like, lines where it's like, can he say that?
But there's a wink in that, like, yeah. I feel like there's, like, but again, maybe we were, like, being too charitable and, like, overreading the wink, right? I don't know, like I, in the early 2000s, I also really loved Dave Chappelle. And I think that, you know, there's a lot.
Who didn't?
Yeah, there's a lot. I think that he is like complicated. I think that people are like bad readers of some of the things that he does. And I think that he's also unsuccessful in some of the things that he's trying to do. Like it falls flat because he's also like a rich asshole now.
Well, I kind of heard a good, a theory of something, somebody was talking about this whole Chappelle thing, and they explained it in a way that made a lot of good sense to me. Like he used to be, he was amazing because he punched up, right? He was always punching up, and maybe he kind of got to the top. There's nowhere else to punch. And he punches down, and it just doesn't fly. Like it's just not, it's not
Yeah.
It's not edgy. It's not nothing. He's now just a rich guy who gets like 25 million bucks a special. And now he punches down and divides my, you know, and it's just, I don't know. It's not the same. It's the same type of humor. Just it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, so I'm going to say that he was punching down before too. We just didn't think of it as such because there was a lot of like misogyny and homophobia in Chappelle's show. So like Desmond and I were like the other day, we were like, let's watch Chappelle because some of them are like so brilliant. We're like, oh, this is so genius. We were rewatching these like old episodes of Chappelle's show and like, it's so brilliant. And then it's just like fucking
I still yell
homophobic.
Wrap it up at people.
Misogynist, like really like, yeah, so like these things are threaded through. It's just like what was legible as punching down and punching up maybe was like different for us than it is now. But yeah, that's like problematic faves. I mean, like Beyonce, problematic fave, like she, you know, I mean, I really think Renaissance is like a masterpiece dance album. Like I teach Lemonade so much because I think it's so complicated and generative. But yeah, problematic lots of ways too.
With Chappelle, I find it really sad that like, you know, he famously quit Chappelle's show, right? After he was given like, what, like $50 million for like a third season?
Turned down
season.
$50 million, yeah.
And he was just like, no, I'm out. Like, I can't do this. It's like compromising my creativity. It's becoming like a minstrel show. And now he's like hanging out with like Elon Musk and you
making
know,
fun of the people that couldn't afford the best seats, even though the worst seats were $160 a pop.
Yeah, it's like sad. It's like there's no escape. You know,
he also have you seen that Mo? I can't remember his last name, a comedian. He's a pretty famous Muslim comedian now. Mo, I wish I could remember. Anyways, Dave Chappelle gave him COVID twice, I think. And he just talks about it in his special. But.
Oh, is that Mo Amer?
Yes, Mo Amer, yes.
Is that the Palestinian guy with the
yes,
show?
Yes, yes.
That's it's a hilarious. Cute show.
It is.
I've been meaning to watch it.
It's like a really sweet, like, cute show, yeah.
It's,
I would recommend
it. He's hilarious. So just as a specific movie, like I want to ask, you've obviously seen a lot of movies. Have you ever seen the movie The Boondock Saints?
Oh,
this is basically like my favorite movie when I was younger, but it was like bar, I quote,
I
like,
I remember a lot of people around me really loving it. Yeah. When
and like my favorite movie quote of all time is from there, but I don't even think I could say it in 2023. Like these are like, it's just like, I'm a different person than when I did love that movie, but I just thought if you'd seen it, I wanted to hear what your thoughts were on it. Cause there's a lot of like Willem Dafoe plays a gay FBI agent, but he's kind of like almost a homophobic gay and like, it's weird. And like,
yeah, I mean, I don't know that film, but I know the kind of thing you're talking about. Like, so Desmond and I have been talking a lot about doing an episode on Fresh Prince, which we both just love and like grew up on.
Totally. It was my
so good.
Yes. Amazing.
So many parts of it that are so smart. Like the
scene with the dad and stuff. Like,
it's so good. And he's so charming and he's so homophobic and it's so like misogynist and like lot, you know, there's lots of that there where you're like, oh, is this like actually like ruining it for me? I think that we can be not so like strict about things like that, right?
Right.
So I don't know, like I would never say like don't like this or whatever. But that's kind of why we have to, I think, really think about what the texts are doing, because at the very least you should be aware. You know,
well, and like it's okay to understand why things might not be viewed like you're a different person, right? Like when you like, you know, people talk about Friends or whatever. Like I when I watched Friends when I was a kid, it was just sort of, and now I watch it now and I'm like, oh yeah, that's kind of whatever, right? Like it's not exactly how I think now, so it's it doesn't resonate the same way. And that's maybe a problem with having something in syndication for 25 years or whatever, because culture changes. Like I remember when, you know, All in the Family was like the show and like a super and it was extremely edgy and really hardcore dealt with race by making its central character a racist, right? So it was like just done in a way that you wouldn't see done now or what have you, but doesn't make it any less of a, you know, iconic show for its time or whatever.
So like the kind of, like, to put it a different way, like the grammar and like lexicon of pop culture changes, right? So it's not even so much about like the individual as being like, I'm a different person now, which like hopefully is true of all of us. But yeah, that like the, like what is like represented changes. And we know this with like genres and like stuff like that too. Like sometimes they're like, let's have a lot of zombie shows or vampire shows, right? And like, oh, like what's going on with like, I don't know, the financial crash that we would want to see things like, do you know what I mean? Like that's about like historicizing, like why are these things popping up at these particular moments and things like that. But
so is that why
No, well, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, is that why dystopian genre is so popular? Because people like watching the society society is gonna decay on us. And
I mean, that seems like a pretty I think that like it doesn't take too much to see like why people would want to see things like that. So like Station 11, I just watched that in the fall and it's like really brilliant, but also was really hard to watch because we still are in this pandemic now, right?
Right.
And yeah, Last of Us, I think, absolutely has a particular cultural purchase right now because we're thinking about, you know, the thing about Last of Us is there is the initial thread of the cordyceps, but after that, yeah, that's sort of there, but it's really that like fascist takeover, right? And like little pockets of like militias and things like that, like that's kind of what's going on. But I haven't watched the most recent one or two, and I know that I've heard that they're trying to make some kinds of claims like the resistance to fascism is also like fascist too, which is a very like Killmonger saying that the sun will never set on the Wakandan Empire. Like that's right. Like a real move,
right?
To like neutralize like anti-fascism, right?
Well, a buddy of mine is really a big gamer, and he said like Last of Us he says like the best storyline, his favorite storyline of all time. And then he said in the second one, and I've never played it, but
no spoilers.
I don't know anything about it. I'm just saying he said that it takes a lot of risks as far as sort of how it approaches certain content and whatnot. Are you finding that at all? Like, does that make sense to hear as I say it? Like, is it pushing the envelope or something?
I need to see what they do with the story, right? So like narrative is a socially symbolic act, but the narrative has to like have ended for me to say what that socially symbolic act is.
Right. That's fair.
But I can see how that would be the case. Like, I think it's doing some like interesting things, but I think like a lot of pop culture is just about neutralizing any kind of like radical critique of the status quo. So again, like making it visible, saying like, no, we know that like police are violent, or we know that this is like the kind of, you know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is such a cute, funny show. And it's like the Rainbow Coalition or whatever in like a new NYPD, you know, precinct.
Right.
And they're so charming, right? Like it's funny, it's charming. And in some ways, it's our fantasy of what we would want that thing that replaces policing to look like, which is just people hanging out doing hijinks and like getting your shit back if it's stolen or like things like that. But they never kill anyone. They're never like doing any like real things that the police do in New York or anywhere. And the last season that was after, you know, 2020, it was so wimpy, liberal, like they were like, okay, Rosa leaves because she's like, I can't be part of the police. Amy's whole thing is like, we need reform. I need funding for my reform. And it's like, no, you need to like abolish yourselves. Like that is like the only thing that needs to happen. And it gets so like, but it's such a charming show, right? So like the costuming of this, you know, real like neutralization of like radicalism is cute and funny,
right,
and melanated and queer, and you know, right?
Do you like The Boys?
I like The Boys in like a kind of conditional sense. Like I think that the premise of the show makes a lot of sense. that if we had like that superheroes would be fascist, right? They would be
like,
the Ubermensch,
like they wouldn't be right? Like all heroes, you mean? Yeah.
It would be like an Ubermensch thing, and they would also be corporatized. Like they would also be incorporated
yep.
into, you know, our like global capitalist system, right? And like turned into spectacle, which like I think the show is really good about showing like how they film everything to like market this superheroes. I think that it participates sometimes in the thing that it thinks that it's critiquing, which is like a lot of its own kind of spectacle and stuff. So I think that it's like treading a kind of line. I don't think it's like as smart as it thinks it is. That's kind of a silly thing to say, but yeah, I think the premise is good.
I wonder how, and I haven't ever read the comic, but I just wonder how much deviation from the like by the time things get on screen, I wonder how much of that is inserted from yeah. the original source material. And have you ever looked into that stuff to see
I've read a couple of the comics, and a lot of the social commentary is added to the show. Like the comics okay. are more like, I think, big on what Sean was calling the spectacle. Like it's very much like, oh, what if superheroes were bad guys and there's this band of misfits, you know, fighting against them? The whole like corporatization and like fascism. And again, I've only read a couple of them, so maybe the comics go more in depth into that later. But that seems to me to be what was added on for the show.
Yeah, so I think that it's also doing this thing that like the fight against fascism will also descend into fascism. And that's something that's like a kind of, it's not like imagining anything outside the logic of like capitalist violence, you know, like racial, patriarchal capitalist violence. And that's, I mean, I don't know. I watched it like a year ago, and I feel like I had like a stronger critique of it that I can't remember now, but I do remember being like disappointed that it wasn't like like there were like opportunities for it to be like more radical, and it did like kind of participate in the same logic that it like thinks it's critiquing.
What are some pieces of pop culture that you would say like
get it right, maybe
get it right, exactly, that are good?
Okay. So a show that I really love is Superstore.
Oh, I've seen every episode twice. So yeah,
I've seen every episode twice. And the reason that I like it, I know that there's a critique of Superstore that it kind of shows like it has like a sentimentality to like the family of the workplace. But I think that there's like something real in that when you spend so much of your time at work, especially in that kind of form of labor. But I think, so what I really like also, cause I'm kind of like a romantic, I think that like Amy and Jonah are my favorite
on-screen couple. Kind of
because they are like a Jane Austen couple. And what I mean by that is that not just that they have a primary like antagonism that then gets like converted into them loving each mm-hmm. other. I think that is like reproduced in lots of ways without doing like what I think is really interesting about their story. And that is that it's so clear throughout the seasons that they make each other better. And that to me is like such a beautiful love story. And it's also so important to me. I don't know if this is a spoiler.
Fine. People can handle yeah. it.
Okay, spoiler.
It's been out a while.
It's really great to me that they have to, I know that it's because America Ferrera wanted to be off the show.
She was pregnant, I think. It was so like wanted much, to be a mom. Yeah.
Yeah, but it makes so much sense, I think, for what kind of a couple that is, mm-hmm. that they would have to separate mm-hmm. and think about how much like they've changed because of each other and then find themselves again. So it's like the perfect love story for me. You know, just because I'm also like a diminutive, like brown woman.
Sure.
Woman, so I'm like, oh, she's like so short and small, like I relate to that. But no, I just think it's like such a like wonderful story, and they are like firmly within their genre of like making things like funny and you know, lighthearted, but they can still do things like, yeah, the company doesn't give a shit about you. Like, ICE is going to fucking deport right. you. No matter how much your work family loves you, the state is going to do violence. And so, like, all of that, I think, was, like, you know, really, really good.
That's what I was going to ask you about, was sort of the way they address the union fight throughout the seasons, because it's not exactly like you know, the young guy wins in the end kind of thing, right?
And so they lose at the end completely. Right. And they have, like, they don't have these, like, good jobs in the end. I mean, I think it's important, like, Jonah is not, like, elected to office or anything. It's just that he's running. Like, that's the most, it's just important that he is, like, motivated to do something. Amy, I guess she's in, like, corporate, whatever. but the other ones are, like, working in an Amazon warehouse, which is, like, a shit job, but, like, they're together. But the last scene is kind of like at their party is actually about, like, the ways that, like, we form, like, kinships, and, like, that is actually, like, a survival strategy within, like, the alienation of capitalism. So I might be like, people might be like, she loves this too much and she's, like, not being critical enough about, like, I know that there are things that, like, you know, they're like radical things that it neutralizes by being like, Amy, like, works in corporate America or whatever. But I don't really care about that much when I think it's doing lots of other things that are really.
It, like, is a very wonderful. Good show. Super funny. Yeah.
Have you watched Severance?
Oh my God. That was the next one I was going to say. I actually think that Severance is doing something very new and interesting as well. I think that Severance is so interesting formally. Like, I've never been so stressed as I was in the last episode of Severance. And so I was just like, the way that it's done is, like, so stressful.
That sounds really enjoyable. I can't wait.
No, to... it's really good.
No, it was masterful. Like, it's the first several episodes, I was like, yeah, no, it's a good concept, but it was, you know, kind of slow paced and wasn't quite sure what they were getting at. And there were so many, like, questions that are still unanswered at the end of the first season, which, you know, is a good setup for future seasons. There's but by the end, I was just like, oh my God, I'm so invested in this. And so, they still don't have a release date for season two, so
I think they'll have it. If they don't, I mean,
no, it's been they're recording it, like, I think they're supposed to wrap up in a couple months, but the release date hasn't been announced.
So, like, one thing that's interesting to me is, like, the ways that, like, labor is represented when this company, it's like a throwaway line, but it was founded, I think, in 1866. So it's like as soon as, like, the biggest form of legal slavery was abolished, this company is trying to find a way to, like, reproduce it, which, of course, it was reproduced through, like, segregation and incarceration and all kinds of other ways generally. But I think that, like, that the racial politics of the show could be, like, really interesting if that's, like, what they're, like, hinting at, right? When they're, like, this company was founded in 1866. So I'm kind of interested in seeing where they go with that. It's really good.
I'll have to watch it. One thing I just watched this week, I just watched the first season of The White Lotus. Have you watched this show?
I love White Lotus.
I've never understood why I love something so much. Like, I'm watching it and I'm just like, I don't know what it's about. Like, you can't explain what it's about. It's almost like scripted reality TV in a way, with sort of nothing but everything happening. I was just, like, so glued to that season. I just thought it was amazingly well done and just so, like, satirical. And so, I don't know, I just thought it was great. But
yeah, I like the second season a lot. I don't know. It's like rich people behaving badly. Like, that can be fun to watch, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a very smart sort of idea of how to do something that is like this sort of glimpse in a life, right? Like, it's just kind of like it zooms in and then zooms back out. And some of the storylines don't even really end, like, you know, like, you don't really find out what in the first season, you don't find out what happens to Kai, actually. Like, you just know that this poor manipulated Hawaiian boy is, like, pretty fucked at the end, right? But just things like that, that I thought like they do a good job of sort of giving you, but not giving you everything. And I don't know, it's a interesting show. So
I fucking loved Armando.
Oh, he's amazing, man. Amazing. I could not, like, I just loved that whole, like, start to finish. I watched it in like 2.5 days.
I like Succession for rich people behaving badly.
I was going to ask you about that next.
I don't have like
we're instinct.
There's like not a lot to say about it except that it's just like pleasurable. I think like the way that the camera makes a lot of jokes is like really kind of fun to watch. Nothing happens, right? It's always like the status quo is like I can't even tell you what happens in the first couple seasons. But something might be different in this newest season that's coming out in March, because I guess the siblings are like finally like banding together against the dad, but nothing really happens. It's just like a bunch of like them talking in the camera, being like funny, like zooming and like moving around and stuff, and all of their like weird psychosexual relations. So, but yeah, Succession is just fun, I think.
That's awesome. So we're at about a buck an hour and 10 here, Jerome. What are we, where are we at?
Well, I guess I just wanted to circle back to my question about video games and whether that was sort of a way to unwind and escape like the horrors of racial capitalism. And of course it wasn't. I'm sorry, is there anything you do to sort of
completely,
you know, like dumb girl stuff, I guess you could say, to just take your mind off of the world as it is? Because I you know, that's something I struggle with too. Like my mind is always on, and I'm sure Scott does as well. And so it's like, how do you practice self-care?
Yeah, I mean, so video games are like a way for me not to think about work in like an explicit way. Like I'm not working, but I'm still thinking about the things I think about at work. I play piano, so that's a thing. And of course that also, like, I do humanities, so like I could be thinking about like form and genre and like things like that, but I actually, like, the physicality of it requires me to like focus in a particular way and like still my brain in a particular way that like is really different, because I have to focus on like phrasing and like sounds that I'm making. But I can't do anything else. Like, I can play video games with like a YouTube of like a lecture or something on in the background sometimes, but when I'm playing piano, I literally like, I can only do that. So it's just such a like intense focus that like it takes up all of my brain energy. So I'm not thinking about work. I'm thinking about others. I don't know. It's like meditative in a way too, but like, I would say that's probably like the number one thing that I do. So I really like playing like Chopin and Beethoven, and like I'm stuck in the 19th century, but I've been playing more like kind of minimalist stuff too. Like sometimes I play Philip Glass and like Max Richter, but I'm pretty stuck in the 19th, like basically Mozart to like Debussy. So like 18th to 19th century into the 20th, but that's the way it goes, man. With classical piano, you get stuck in, that's like, it's almost like some like piano, like the height of piano is like 19th century. So yeah, that's what I do. And I talk to friends. Oh, I talk to friends and stuff. Like, you know, I'm always like chatting and texting and sending memes and shit like that. So, you know.
So what else do you want to talk about?
I mean, I think that's it. You know, we've you know, gone a bit, I would say, over our average length. And I mean, I could ask Shama about pop culture all fucking day.
I just got like a list of like 20 movies I want to ask her about. Yeah. But
what do you feel like? Are you in any Ken Loach films?
Oh man, I feel like I was watching, like I watched like some with like I had this like partner for a few years, like a long time ago, was really into film, but I think it was like the animals. Like I can't watch like Animals in Peril. This is really stupid. It's like with the video games, like when I'm playing Last of Us, I'm like killing so many humans. And then when I have to shoot a dog, I'm like,
this so, is bullshit.
I know. Cause like the Ken Loach wasn't like, didn't he do Kes? And I was like, I can't watch that.
Yeah. Like, Kes was like his,
something
debut.
Happens to Kes. So I,
yeah. Yeah, but it's a great metaphor for like
Yeah, it's like Oazar, Balthazar, right? With like, I'm like, not, I don't, the donkey's not going to live at the end, so.
I can't. But yeah,
I mean, Loach's more recent stuff is also like fantastic. Like, I think his last movie was Sorry We Missed You, which is like this good sort of send up of the gig economy. And it's this guy who's like delivering packages for this Amazon type company, and his wife is like this part-time like long-term care nurse, which, and this was before the pandemic, so it's very prescient, and just showing how like the gig economy is like impacting like public health care as well, and it just how it destroys like our interpersonal relationships. And I mean, that's really the big theme of like Loach's films, is just how capitalism like destroys us, not just individually, but like as a collective.
Alienation. And yeah.
But I feel like there's a critique in there of his films, because they're very, it's very like white working class, at least mm-hmm. the ones I've seen. Like you don't see a lot of like racialized people in his films, but.
Which is not, like, it's not that, like, I don't know, because I'm not really invested in representational politics. So I'm like, if something is doing the things that it wants to do well and like coherently, and is, you know, I don't like, this is why I don't like things like the Bechdel test. I think it's stupid, but now I'm going to get canceled for saying that. But I'm like, it can tell us something about like women in the industry as a whole or whatever, but if you apply it to any individual film, I don't think that it really like is meaningful.
What about Paul Thomas Anderson films?
Yeah, so I wrote a dissertation chapter. This is one I haven't published because I have to figure out what to do with it, because it's a very strange chapter that is on Upton Sinclair's Oil, and a lot of like Marxist theory, and There Will Be Blood, and Derrida's Spectres of Marx, and Hauntology. And so There Will Be Blood, so yeah, when I was saying that, I that is my example of like, there's like no women really in that film. There are, but like not really speaking, and it's so, because the point of it is thinking about like resource extraction and like masculinity and like penetration, and like, yeah, it's just, you, it's fine to me that there's like no women or like racialized, like people who are racialized not as white in that movie. Yeah, it's like a masterpiece, and so yeah, I spent a lot of time with that film for my dissertation.
Yeah, I feel like this like white male anger that's sort of related to capitalism is like a big theme like throughout his films. Though I don't know if he would like specifically like identify it that way, because I don't know what his politics are, but
I think Punch Drunk Love is really good.
That's the one I haven't seen.
Yeah, it's really good. I didn't like Inherent Vice. I don't know, I haven't seen the pizza one that came out.
It's good. It's like delightful and charming. It doesn't quite hit the same way as like There Will Be Blood or The Master or Magnolia. It's more like a lighthearted romp, but I liked it a lot.
Word. Are you guys ready? Should we wrap her up?
Yeah.
Have you guys seen The Menu yet, by the way?
Yeah.
Is it any good? People keep telling me to watch it, but
I almost liked it. Like I saw it's one of those movies where I think the trailer was way better than the movie itself.
Right.
I saw the trailer and I was like, I gotta see this. This seems mm-hmm. crazy. And like it starts off strong, and then I think it kind of falls apart, though a lot of people I know whose taste I respect liked it more.
They liked it a lot. So. Yeah.
I didn't see that, but I saw Triangle of Sadness, which also like ultimately has pretty terrible politics, but is like kind of, it's like very funny, and there's some good moments of it. And it reminded me of like a Buñuel film in the 21st century, the kind of like scatological stuff that Buñuel maybe couldn't show in like the mid 20th century. So I don't know. I it has not good politics though, but it's there's some fun parts, like when the captain is like, I'm a Marxist, not a communist. I thought that was maybe the funniest line in that film.
Well, there's definitely, like, I think we're, the common theme here today is that maybe the politics and a lot of things that are out there aren't very good, but watch for yourselves, decide for yourselves, I guess. But there's some entertainment value in these things as well.
Or maybe just think about media literacy, like, in lots of different ways, right? So you've talked to lots of journalists, I'm sure, on this podcast where they talk about, like, having media literacy for, like, news and stuff. But I think we need to also, I mean, I don't know, this is, like, my job is to, like, teach students how to, like, read things. So, yeah, just, like, it's the importance of being able to read pop culture, take it seriously. You know, it's, like, the water we're swimming in.
Mm-hmm.
Ideology erases its own existence, right? But, like, let's, like, reveal it.
It's a good way to end. I like that line. I wish the viewers could see the snap that went with it, but, or the listeners could see the snap that went with it, but they'll just have to imagine themselves. It was good. But Chama, we just want to thank you so much for being on the show, especially giving us this kind of time today. And it was awesome. We weren't exactly sure where we were going to go with the conversation, but racking your brain about movies and pop culture and film and whatnot was awesome. Really fun and really interesting. And you probably ruined the MCU for me, but that's fine. I'm gonna say
the MCU has ruined itself, because this multiverse bullshit is basically like nothing matters at all.
That's how comic books get away with erasing anything they don't want. Like, they're like, oh, that didn't work. Oh, we better bring that
multiverse,
guy back.
Multiverse. I mean, the thing, so I did write an article about Marvel movies in the Trump era for the American Canadian Review of American Studies. And one of my arguments was, like, if Trump didn't exist, like, liberals would have to invent him. And so it's like a Thanos thing where, like, the fantasy is that you can have this villain whose, like, villainy is rooted in, like, a real problem, which is, like, climate crisis, right? So he's, like, scarcity, like, let's just kill half of the people. But the fantasy is that not only can you, reverse that, but you can keep anything that's good that happened in the meantime. So, like, Tony Stark's daughter, like, doesn't get reversed. And so it's just, like, the most, like, liberal, like, anyway. But, yeah, the MCU has ruined itself. Like, I mean, the new movies are all, like, so terrible. Nothing matters.
So I won't tell you what I'm doing tomorrow afternoon, then. We'll just leave it at that.
I was about to say, I'm still going to see them all just because I've invested so much time.
I'm literally, like, 13 years into, or what, 15 years in now to, I think 08 was Iron Man, where I've seen literally every scene of literally everything they've actually produced. And now it's like, I just can't. I couldn't stop if I wanted to.
I'm going to watch them all too, but I'm just saying that, like, even the pleasures of, like, the earlier movies, I think have been, like, destroyed by this, like, multiverse bullshit.
Nothing matters. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that they've taken what comic books have always been known for, and like, obviously the multiverse was invented in the books, but, like, this is why they come up with these things, is so they can, like, they killed off this character. Oh shit, nobody liked that.
Don't worry about it.
Profits went down, so we better bring that character back, but we can't just make them not dead, so we have to do this. And it allows them to, like, they've always done that. So, I mean, I guess it hits me not as hard, but, like, I grew up with that kind of concept that, like, no one's dead. Like, no one's gone. Nothing bad's happened. It's all whatever. You
know, the last one I enjoyed, and though there are lots of problems with it, and it was very much like style over substance, was the last Spider-Man movie. Like,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But I mean, it was very much a symptom of that multiverse. Nothing matters.
I like the new Doctor Strange too, but I'm a huge Sam Raimi Evil Dead fan. So, like, the nod to, like, it's just a 2-hour nod to Evil Dead. That's all it is. It's like, hey, did you like that when you were a kid? Yeah. Well, here you go. Here it is again. It's like, please have my money. I'm so easy that way. Like, all you got to do is, like, touch a chord from my childhood. And I'm like, here you go. Here's $20.
Yeah, nostalgia is, like, a part of the, you know, the cultural logic of late capitalism.
Right. I know. I am the problem. I understand that we're realizing this today, but
Yeah, it's like, remember that time when everything didn't suck?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Ah, oh, the good old days.
The long 90s after the Cold War, before 9/11, when history stopped for very particular people in the global north.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, something like that. Well, anyways, we even derailed our attempt to get out of the episode. So I like that we this episode really went in any direction it decided. But again, once again, thank you so much. And I want to wish you luck out in Toronto and at your new job at York University. And I hope that it is everything you hope it was when you went, and that you meet some people soon so you can establish a circle.
Yeah, it's really nice. Lots of Harbinger folks are out here, so yeah.
Yeah, let's go to a Jays game when I'm back next with the Harbinger crew.
That would be
We'll get the Harbinger Avengers to assemble.
That would be such a nice, like, COVID safe thing to do, to go to a baseball game.
100%. Yep, roof open.
Yeah. Okay, well, it was lovely to speak with both of you. So
well, thank you so much for being here.
Oh yeah, and listen to replay. There aren't that many episodes, so you can catch up.
So you're going to be able quick. To catch them. Yep. Well, and, we'll put a link too in the notes.
Yeah. And I look forward to hearing you and Desmond talk about the next piece of pop culture you're going
to
ruin.
Can't wait for you to ruin something else for me. Appreciate it. All right, you guys, this is the time in the show where we do thank those of our patrons who go well above and beyond anything we could hope for by basically supporting our show themselves. To Farah Chaudhry, Niccolo Di Nicola, Chris Durwell, Dave Bonmiller, and Darius Beauregard, you guys are all the bomb. To our anonymous and late anonymous and everyone else that's out there, we love you guys. To our patrons, you guys are all great. And to all listeners, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for coming.
Bye-bye.
Actually, I lied that time. I said next week because that's what we used to do. But we'll see you when we're back.